Welcome again, everyone, to the magical, the mystical, the amazing Disney Film Project podcast. Hello and welcome. I am your host, Ryan Kilpatrick, of this here show where we discuss the films of the Walt Disney Company in all their myriad splendor. I run the site DisneyFilmProject.com where I blog and we post this here podcast and we talk about tweet watches and we do all kinds of fun stuff. So head over there if you have not and you are listening to this program. With me this evening, we have two amazingly fine film buffs who have chosen to sit here and spend hours of their lives discussing Disney films with yours truly, for which I cannot be more grateful. First of all, we have Mr. Todd Perlmutter, a blogger at touringplans.com and chief technical officer of DisneyDrivenLife.com. How are you, Todd?
I'm doing good. Work stunk, but I'm good.
I can sympathize and relate. But that's a story for another day.
Well, you know, that's why I do this, because this is a sanity check.
There you go. This
if
is
you say so.
Well, for us, Cheryl does all the extra.
I think it's an insanity check. That's all I'm saying. If you knew how crazy, wonky, slushes he gets, folks, that's all I'm saying.
That I can believe.
Well, you know, sometimes to be sane, you check your sanity at the door. Just saying.
That's deep, man.
That is deep.
All right. So let's extricate ourselves from that Mobius strip of logic and talk with one Miss Brianna Alessio, who is a world-renowned blogger at The Adventures of Bree at adventuresofbree.blogspot.com. Hello, Bree.
Hello, Sir Ryan. How are you today?
Just fine. Are you going to use the accent throughout the entire show? That would be awesome.
I would try to, but I'm afraid I will slip out of it.
It would be a good acting exercise for you.
It would be. Oh, look at that. I'm American again.
No, it didn't last very long, did it? And as mentioned, the person who does all the actual work on this program is one Cheryl Perlmutter, who takes these conversations that we have and records them and then edits them into some semblance of coherence, because let me assure you that when they are going on, they are not that. How are you, Cheryl?
Doing good.
All right. So this evening, folks, we will be discussing, and I say this evening because it's evening when we're recording. It's probably not evening when you're listening, and that's okay. We can all agree that the space-time continuum will not fold, and we'll move on with life. However, we will be discussing this evening the 1971 release from the Walt Disney Productions Studio, distributed by Buena Vista Distribution Company, Incorporated, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, starring Miss Angela Lansbury, Mr. David Tomlinson, and a host of others, in a tale designed to capitalize on the success of Mary Poppins, I think it's safe to say. I think anyone at Disney at the time would admit that. But one that, in my humble opinion, does not get its due as its own separate movie and as a Disney film that should be discussed and viewed and enjoyed. So, henceforth, we shall discuss it here. Huzzah.
Huzzah.
Thank you. They're just humoring.
That's how we roll.
Yes, exactly. All right, so Bedknobs and Broomsticks is based on a book known as The Magic Bedknob or How to Become a Witch in 10 Easy Lessons, as well as parts of Bonfires and Broomsticks, both written by Mary Norton. It was released in America in 1971, on December 13th to be exact. It stars Angela Lansbury and David Tomlinson, as I mentioned. It's very much, it's an attempt to recreate the magic of Mary Poppins, and that's down to just about everything. So the music in the film is done by the Sherman Brothers, the director is Robert Stevenson, art director is Peter Ellenshaw, music director Irwin Kostal. I mean, all of the same cast of characters from Mary Poppins, with the exception of Dame Julie Andrews, who is not present in this film, and although she was considered, from what I understand, for the lead role of Miss Eglantine Price that went to Angela Lansbury.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been a much different movie.
Yes, it would have.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think it's because it's the Sherman Brothers, and, you know, they have that way of sticking in people's memories, and, you know, people just generally really, who are Disney fans especially, really just draw to their songs and, you know, hum them out, and even if they don't realize it.
Yeah, it's weird, right? Because the Sherman Brothers songs are from the Parks and from Mary Poppins. I would imagine that most people listening to this podcast know the vast majority of those. I don't know that those folks, those same people, would know the songs from this movie, which is right. Weird to me.
Yeah, I mean, like, you would more commonly hear someone speak of Feed the Birds from Mary Poppins more so than a song from this film.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I've watched this movie probably as much in my life, as many times in my lifetime as I've watched Mary Poppins, just because, you know, they're, well, okay, it's actually younger than I am.
And you're going to cling to that? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's important to note. I mean, it's just, you know, I like movies like this a lot because it doesn't take itself seriously. That's one of the things I really enjoy about Mary Poppins, right? Is it's a movie with a very serious undertone that doesn't take itself too seriously. I think that's why people find both movies the similarities between them so strong is because they are designed the same way. Even though, despite the similarities, I mean, the way they're laid out, the way they play out, the like I said, the serious undertone with the not taking itself serious story on top. So I think that's why I really like this movie is because it's like Mary Poppins, it's got that serious undertone with that not taking itself serious overtone and story and plot and the whole nine yards. I mean, everything is just there to be there and be enjoyed. And not to put too much thought into, especially like at the end when I'm telling Charlotte, you know how this movie ends, right? And she goes, "What?" And I go, "So the Nazis attack." And she's like, "Not." She looks at me. She goes, "You're not serious, right?" I go, "No, the Nazis, they attack."
I love it.
Well, oh my God. To be fair, that is what Nazis do.
Yes.
True.
So, Todd, you said you had seen this like 10 times or more beforehand. Bree, had you seen this before?
I have never seen this.
So this was your first time?
Yes. Very interesting.
Any preconceived notions going in?
Not really. I was just expecting a really good time throughout the movie, and that is exactly what I had.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, so this is a long movie. If you watch the director's cut, which I'm assuming we all did, because it's the only version that is now available on DVD. Am I correct in that?
We have the Enchantical Music Edition.
That is the director's cut. It's because the reason why there's a difference is the movie was re-released. 79, right? It was released in 71. It was re-released in 79, right. And they basically cut all the music out of it, except for a couple songs. And so this is the director's cut that has all this stuff and all the missing dialogue put back into it. Because remember, the version that we watched is like, you know, it's almost 3 hours long, but the version that was re-released in 79 is I think just a little under 2 hours long.
So the film has a long and sordid history of cuts. It's kind of a weird story because it was premiered in 71 at actually a longer length than what we saw. The version we have is like 2.5 hours, I want to say, 2 hours, 35 minutes, something like that. That's the one that's now available on DVD. The version that was in the original premiere, the big premiere, was around 3 hours. So it was a Happiest Millionaire-esque length. The version that Todd is talking about, the version with everything missing, is from the re-release. So they cut all the songs except for Portobello Road and Beautiful Briny Sea out, even Age of Not Believing, which was up for the Academy Award. I mean, there have been lots of different versions of the songs in the movie. There's been lots of problems. But so the version that's on the DVD, the problem that we have there is that a lot of things were just completely cut out of the movie after it was originally in the premiere. So when they showed it for the critics and the stars and that sort of thing, it was closer to a three-hour movie. And they cut out a bunch of stuff. So songs that A Step in the Right Direction, nobody's problems, things like that, that were in the original cut, but, you know, the full orchestration wasn't done and things like that. They cut those out of the movie, and unfortunately the footage is gone, and the orchestration never was completed and things like that. So there's about 20 minutes of the movie that's not actually in the final cut that we have on DVD. And then in addition to that, the soundtrack to the parts that they did put back in. So they put in Roddy McDowell's character, who he plays a priest trying to get on the good side of Eglantine Price, Angela Lansbury's character. There was no vocal work from him. So they had to come in with him about 25 years later and have him dub in his lines. So you see Roddy McDowell in 1971, and you're hearing Roddy McDowell in 1996. And Angela Lansbury the same. And then David Tomlinson, in his a lot of his areas, you will hear his voice. It's not him. It's an actor that had to dub in for him in that footage. The footage doesn't look as good. So there's a lot of issues with the DVD release, and they've cleaned it up as best they could digitally, but I just don't want people to hold that against the movie when they watch it.
There is a plus to it versus the original. The music and the sound in the movie was originally all mono, and in the re-release, because it was all actually recorded in stereo, it's actually re-released in stereo.
Yeah.
So there's a plus side to everything.
And it also makes the plot works a little better with the stuff that they added. Some of the things that are back in there, you know, it makes a little more sense. I mean, one thing that was cut out is in the very beginning of the movie, they talk about the children who come to live with Miss Price, and she asked them, you know, what happened to their parents, and that part was cut out of the original movie. So that was dubbed, that was put back in, and that to me gives the kids a little more emotional resonance, and makes it work a little better. And that's just one example.
Especially Charlie, who, except because after that, I find Charlie to be the hardest of the kids to like. And that may be intentional because of what goes on in the movie, but just the same, he's I don't know. I feel without that, the other kids will probably, you know, probably play fine in the movie. But if you don't have that, Charlie just lacks any real depth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the one thing that I've always been curious about, and I've always liked the movie, I've watched it many, many times, is I don't think they do a great job of explaining what's going on in Britain at the time. So you would kind of have to know. So I'm curious for Bree, who is somebody who is watching this for the first time, like, did you get why the kids were being relocated and all that kind of stuff?
You know, I did, because for some reason, the whole entire beginning of this film reminded me of portions of The Sound of Music.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, it just had some kind of parallel ways there. But, yeah, I mean, I understood it right away. For some reason, it just kind of clicked. I didn't really have to think too hard about that, but, yeah.
Okay, because what's going on in the beginning of the movie is there's a bunch of kids from London, because this is set during 1940 London. And, of course, during that time, London is being bombed by the Germans to try and get the British to surrender, and the Nazis take over the UK. And so they sent all these kids out of London to live in the countryside where they wouldn't get bombed all the time.
Right. And they make a point to the kid. One of the things that the kid said is that their aunt dies in a bomb, in a bomb attack.
Right.
So,
but in that's what I was talking about in the 117 minute version of the movie, that's not in there.
Yep.
So I'm sure I'm remembering it from when I was a kid and seeing that version is why it didn't make as much sense. But for me, like, I'm a World War II history buff, so this like scratches a sweet spot for me.
Awesome.
No, that's fair. So can we, in the very beginning of the movie, right, the opening credits, they actually, the tapestry that they show is actually a real thing, right? Did you read up on this at all?
I did not. I'm very curious.
Okay.
Please.
So it's based on the Bayeux tapestry, which is a real tapestry that was made by monks, and it's for it tells the story of William the Conqueror versus Harold, the Earl of Essex, who was trying to they led the Norman and the Saxon armies in the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Incidentally, Battle of Hastings on my birthday, and fought on October 14th. That's my birthday. So it tells that whole story. So while you probably, you know, without knowing that, you probably think that it's actually depicting like the Germans and the animated suits of armor at the end, but what it's really doing is it's actually depicting the Normans and the Saxons, and she alludes to that in the movie. Miss Haldi or whatever her name is, the shopkeeper lady,
the post everything
mistress in the movie.
Yeah, the person who runs Pepper and Jai.
That's right. She alludes to it in the movie. Is she says, you know, when we fought off the Danes, that's
the Yenta.
Pretty much the Yenta, yeah. She's the Yenta Talavera. Yes.
There you go.
Bring back the Yiddish.
I like it.
Because he even says in the movie, she's a busybody and a matchmaker. So there you go. Hobday, yep. That's her name. I can never remember her name because I just think of her as the annoying lady.
Yeah, it's not that important. So you're telling me like the tapestry that's in the beginning of this movie with the Nazis in it is that one, or did they like take
No. It's literally the scenes it depicts are the exact scenes that you could go find on this actual tapestry.
Okay. It's just with different characters.
Just with different character stuff, like, because the actual tapestry, it has all this stuff on it. It has boats and creatures and mystical beings and stuff like that all on the real tapestry. And you know, in the tapestry you see in the beginning, it plays the same way because it's all about, but it shows the suits of armor and the Germans instead of, you know, the Normans and the Saxons, and instead of the mythical beast, it's actually showing it's supposed to be showing the Nibumbum character, Mumbu characters, but you don't realize that until later on. So
So now that we have solved the mystery of the Isle of Nibumbu, I guess it probably would do us some good to talk briefly through the plot. It's a long, long movie with a long and complicated plot, so I don't want to summarize the entire thing and take everything away from the viewers, especially from people who may have not actually seen the movie and listen to us and say, wow, what a wonderful movie, I need to go see it. But, you know, we can talk through kind of what the basic premise is and kind of where things end up. Like Todd said, here's a spoiler, there's Nazis.
Right. So like you were saying, Ryan, it's set in World War II, right? Before the US has entered the war.
Right.
Okay. The Nazis are they are bombing and they are preparing, at this point they're preparing to attack Britain because the Germans were trying to take over the world. Okay, that was their ultimate goal. They saw Britain as an important part of that because prior to that, Britain was considered to have been the ruler of the world kind of thing, because they still, you know, up until the mid-20th century, they were, you know, they still owned parts of Africa, they were partly responsible for the existence of Australia, and on and on and on and on. Well, not the existence of Australia, but the creation of the Australian nation, mm-hmm. and on and on and on and on. So it all feeds into it. So the Germans saw this as something that they had to defeat. Now, it's interesting because the bombing went on for years at this point, and for some reason the Germans never mustered a full attack against Britain, and that was, I think, even from a historic perspective, that's never entirely clear, other than that perhaps by that time we had already started breaking, the Britons had started breaking their codes, the U.S., even though they weren't part of the war, they were helping the Allied powers work towards breaking.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different reasons that people don't agree upon, but you know, we can talk about that on our next show, which will be the military history podcast.
Right. It's August. It's 1940. Right, and I like they have the little quote in the beginning there, which I don't think is in the shortened version, right? That's also another that quote.
Yeah, I think it's missing. Yes.
Yeah, which is it says again a time for valid, a time of whispered events now faded with the passing years. That's a reference to both the war itself and to the story.
And so we talked about the three Rawlins children, Charlie, Carrie, and Paul, are sent to this village of Pepperidge Eye to live with Eglantine Price, played by Angela Lansbury. And of course, she's dead set against this at the beginning of the movie, like in any good Disney movie. You know, she doesn't want the kids around, and then of course she falls in love with them throughout the course of the film. But we find out the reason why she does not want them around is because she is trying to help the war effort in her own way. And it's something that, again, to understand sort of the time period, like everybody in Britain and once the Americans entered the war in America was asked to in some way contribute to the war effort, to in some way beat the Nazis back or beat the Axis powers back. So Miss Price's way to do that is she has become a witch. And she is attending the Correspondence College of Witchcraft under the tutelage of Professor Amelius Brown, and she is learning various and sundry spells that she will use in the defense of Britain in the case of a Nazi invasion.
Yes.
And if that sounds far-fetched, it is. It's also quite amusing.
Yes.
Indeed.
It's basically the whole non-seriousness of the movie, the whole overtone I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I just want to mention the brilliance of Reginald Owen, who played General Teebler. Although he's in it for such a short amount of time, like, he really did a great job. I think he should have been in it longer. I don't know where he would have fit in, but he really did a good job.
Yeah, did you know it's his last film role?
Was it?
Yeah, it's the last film he was ever in.
Because I know him so well from the growing up on the 1938 version of A Christmas Carol. Like, I used to watch that all the time with my dad on TCM.
Yep.
Props to TCM. And,
also in Mary Poppins.
And yep. Mary Poppins, exactly. The Crazy Neighbor.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Crazy neighbor is an understatement there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they spend a lot of time actually, you know, establishing the characters and the village of Pepperidge Eye with, you know, from the opening shot all the way through with all those characters. So it's interesting. It's stuff that doesn't really play into the plot of the movie so much. But, you know, Reginald Owen as the captain of the Home Guard, the busybody woman we talked about, you know, lots of different things. And they don't actually spend a lot of time in Pepperidge Eye either. So
yeah,
just it's an interesting decision. But it's fun. I mean, it's fun stuff to watch.
It's based on a real place called Peppering Eye.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I don't understand how British addresses work out, but it's Battle East Sussex. So I presume Battle is the county, and East Sussex is a region. So, and I know I just realized I said that wrong, but that's okay. And it's very. Peppering Eye, the real place, is very famous for the farm that's there. So it's very. She lives on a farm, and that the farm that she lives in is basically very similar to the famous farm. So that's.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay. Cool.
Interesting. So they were trying to be somewhat historically accurate.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. So the problem, you have to accept that central premise that Angela Lansbury's character, Miss Price, is going to fight off the Nazis through witchcraft. And if you accept that, then everything else makes sense throughout the entire movie. Like, her motivation stays strong throughout the entire film.
Yes.
It's just, you have to take that first leap, and then you're good.
I love her first appearance when she first shows up on the motorcycle, and she's clearly burning sulfur, but they say, no, it can't be sulfur. Because you can't make you can't run a motorcycle on sulfur, but it's clearly burning it. What it reminded me of is in The Wizard of Oz when the witch writes in the sky, it's that same type of look and feel of the smoke.
Yes. So. I agree.
Yep. So the kids, where the title basically comes in is the kids see her, she gets a spell to learn how to fly on a broomstick, which reminded me a lot of the first Harry Potter movie, but that's a whole other thing. And so they find out that she's a witch. They blackmail her in exchange for them not saying anything about her being a witch to the village folk. She agrees to give them a spell. She gives them a bed knob that allows them to travel anywhere that the youngest child, Paul, asks it to go. So that's where the title comes from, Bed Knobs and Broomsticks. So they have this bed then that can take them anywhere. And the rest of the movie is basically them chasing down a spell that's going to help her fight the Nazis using this bed. And they travel through several different locations in order to do that. So it's an interesting premise in that sense. And along the way, they go and they meet Emilius Brown, who's played by David Tomlinson, who is the quote unquote professor of the Correspondence College of Witchcraft. And he accompanies them throughout the rest of the film as they go to find this last spell that they need in order to fight the Nazis.
That's
the setup. I don't want to spoil too much. Yeah, I don't want to spoil too much for people who haven't seen it. And we can talk about other parts of the movie, but I mean, that's the basic setup, right? Is that they have the traveling bed and they're chasing this spell.
I think it's great how when Emilius Brown makes his entrance, he's singing to the townsfolk, "I'm a fraud, I'm a hoax," and yet they all stand there watching him still. He's telling them that he's a hoax, and, you know, they persist on just watching him and saying, "Oh, okay, I'm okay with that.
Right, he's a magician, and he clearly refers to himself as a charlatan, right? That's a line in the song, right? So that's not a slight to magicians out there. Okay, so he is not a wizard, right? That's the important thing. But he's a con artist. That's what it boils down to.
Exactly.
And his whole point is the song is he's saying it doesn't matter what I say or do, it matters how I present it, because if I present it and I'm entertaining to you, you don't really care. That's without saying what the lyrics to the song are or what he's actually singing or what he's doing in the time. That's what's going on. But it's one of those moments where there are a few movies that do similar things. You're not actually sure that what we're hearing him say is what the townspeople are hearing him say. What's really going on is we're hearing what he's singing to the people watching the movie, what he's thinking, and he's actually performing a number for everyone else, and they're just buying into it, and it's not.
Okay.
Hearing that.
That's the way I took it too, because and that's this time around the way I took it. The first 100 times I saw it, I don't think I picked up on that.
Yeah, I doubt when I was 4 and I saw it that I thought that either. So
right, yeah, because there's little spoken bits during the song, and so that's where I picked up on it. There's a part where he attempts to put a nail through a solid pane of glass, and while the music is playing underneath it, he's speaking the lyrics. So I assumed, like, okay, that's what he's actually talking to the people about, and then he sings his song. Like you said, I think it's his thoughts. I think you're correct on that. I think that's probably what the intent was.
I have to know what you guys think of the transition of the mattress with the whole true 1970s kaleidoscopic trippy thing going on.
Dude, hyperspace.
Right.
That's what
totally.
I'm thinking.
Is that what the kids are calling it these days?
So hyperspace. Totally.
Yeah, the special effects in this one, not good.
Oddly, though, that's
actually didn't they have as part of the bonus features a thing about the special effects?
Oh, it goes better than
with
that.
With the girl from Wizards of Waverly Place,
Gerald.
Right?
Gerald.
Yeah.
They won the Academy Award for Visual Effects.
Okay.
Which is insane.
Welcome to the 1970s.
But it's the 70s, and that stuff was really good in the 70s. And it, truthfully, what we see at the end with all the suits of armors and and weaponry and stuff like that, that's actually really amazing green screening.
I think
it was actually back then they didn't do green screening. It was still blue screening back then, but same concept.
Right.
And when I say the effects, I mean like what Bree's talking about, like the transitions of the bed and things like that are really bad.
And the whole 70s concept just reminded me so much of the Chicky Baby guy from Herbie.
Chicky Baby.
Chicky Baby.
One of the actors was also on H.R. Puffin stuff.
Oh yes. Okay, so this actor wasn't just on H.R. Puffin stuff. He's like the most outside of the live actors, he's the guy who does the bird, and he does the Lion King of Naboombo, okay? And he does tons of voices. Well, he's like, you know, my favorite guy on in the movie, basically, in terms of actors, right? I mean, not that I don't like Angela Lansbury and Tomlinson and stuff like that, but, you know, if I was to pick anybody else, it would be him. I mean, if you go down all the stuff that he does, this is – his name is – Lenny Weinrib, but he does all sorts of characters like Fred Flintstone and characters from Batman. He was Hunk and Prince Lotor in Voltron. Characters from the Smurfs. He was Scrappy Doo. He did voices on the Kraft Superstars show, and prior to that, he was HR Puffin Stuff, and he was in. He did voices in Lidsville as well. He was on the in the 70s. There was the New Adventures of Batman, which was a Saturday morning cartoon for me. He did Commissioner Gordon, the Joker, the Penguin. That the New Adventures of Batman is incidentally the one that crosses over with Scooby Doo.
Oh, okay.
On and on and on. Just tons and tons of animated stuff that, you know, and I just love it. He was, Gomez Adams on the Addams Family animated series, you know.
Oh, nice. Cool.
Wow. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Stanley Chan on The Amazing Chan and the Chan Clan.
Wait, he was Stan Lee?
No, Stanley Chan. Oh. Not Stan Lee.
Oh, okay. That would be a whole different thing.
Yes. Indeed it would.
Yeah, but you're right. The special effects at the end, they find the spell and they animate these suits of armor to fight the Nazis, which is the kind of the climax of the film. And it's just a very well-done blue screen, like you said. Although I personally think that sequence does go on a bit long.
Actually. Can I just say, biggest museum ever?
Yeah.
I mean, right? Because it doesn't look that big when you're walking up to it, and it doesn't really look like there's all that much stuff in it, but there are, like, battalions and battalions and battalions of various British and Norman and Saxon armies from throughout the ages and on and on and on. You know, even redcoats are in there. It's crazy.
Yeah, there's a little bit of everything in that museum, isn't there?
I don't know. Though, it does go on and on and on, but I like the bullet jokes a little bit.
Yeah.
And yes, everybody, there are actual bullet jokes in the movie. It's hard to explain without, like, ruining too much.
I wish these bullet jokes were in The Rocketeer. I think that's what The Rocketeer may have needed.
With suits of armor and bullet jokes?
With bullet jokes. That's bullet jokes. That's a suits of armor. That's a few bullet jokes.
Just bullet jokes? So there's also a large animated sequence in here. So one of the places that they travel to is an animated island populated by animals known as the Isle of Naboombo.
Yes.
As Todd so eloquently put it. and that sequence was directed by Ward Kimball. My personal hero, Renaissance man, Ward Kimball, animator, train engineer, famous Dixieland jazz musician. You know, I think he did just about everything. But he directed the sequence, which is why it has the crazed energy that sequence does. Because, I mean, Ward Kimball was known for just really outrageous, you know, kind of crazy energy in his sequences. Like he did the crows in Dumbo. He did the sequence, if you've ever seen the Three Caballeros, where those guys are introduced, where everything's like popping in and out of frame and things like that. And so this is a little more traditional because he has to interact with the live action animals. But like just the animation of the animals playing soccer and what they're doing to each other is like we talked about this before when you were talking about Cars 2, Todd, about how you could take pieces of the movie and make your own little shorts out of it. Like,
right.
The whole Isle of Naboombo sequence you could make into its own little short, and it would be very entertaining on its own.
Right, it's like it's like the Humphrey the Bear stuff, right? Same. It's got that, you know, you could always just take pieces of that and see it and you know, use it wherever kind of thing. And, well, Humphrey the Bear does happen with, so.
Yeah.
I do have some trivia based upon these scenes.
Okay, go for it.
One in the Sarka game, a bear was wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt in the crowd.
Oh, how about that?
And cute. Then the other one is that one of the characters, the hyena... when the king kicks the hyena, you hear the goofy holler.
That's right.
Oh, very interesting.
I remember that. I heard that.
There are actually some things that I want to talk about here, too, is that what's very interesting is you learn in this scene that Miss Price has already started to fall for Emilius Brown. Okay. And because she refers to him as being a very brave man when he's going in with all the animals and stuff like that. But what's very funny is earlier on when they're entering the house at 8 Winchfield Street, okay, is when he sees the bomb, he says, it's very interesting because I'm really just a coward. Right? He refers to himself as a coward, yet here she is. She sees him as a very brave man. So because we see him change from being the charlatan to being the hero, basically, towards the end of the movie, right?
Right.
Right.
And but she always perceived him as something different and more. From near as I can tell by this, because even at this point, we still think he's just a con man, right?
Would you say? Well, would you say always, or would you say, like, to me, I felt like the point at which that changes is when they're right before this, when they're in the situation with the bookman. I felt like that's the point at which she starts kind of looking at him a little different way, because when they're during the whole Portobello Road scene, she's kind of irritated with him.
No, you're right. Clearly, that when he is owning up to the fact. Well, that's kind of sort of bravado, more, which is different than being brave. But
yeah.
Okay. But you're right. Her perception of that him changes at that point. But she's not really completely upset with him. She's more frustrated that she's not finding her book at Portobello Road, because she's very smiley and happy and dancing with him. Otherwise, you know, at a couple points in there,
she doesn't dance with him. That's very important. She doesn't dance with him on Portobello Road.
Okay.
It's the sailors grab her while she's looking for book.
Right. Well, there's one point where he kind of steps up to her and kind of takes her arm, but I guess that's right before the Portobello Road closes. So you're right.
Exactly. Yeah, it's right at the very end. She's kind of thawing out, and then they go into the scene with the bookman, and their lives are threatened, and he helps them out, and that's to me kind of where it all starts coming together, and we get a little love in the situation.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say is that you're right, because between the time when they go to the bookman and the time when he becomes the referee for the soccer match is that's when they have their dance number, and I think that's when things change. You know, there's always that point when things in a relationship in a movie change. It's the dancing under the sea, the beautiful briny sea.
Exactly.
Which is a fabulous song.
Yes, it is. back to the Under the Sea thing, it was not the same tempo of music as Under the Sea from Little Mermaid, but I can see where Little Mermaid actually stole the picturesque nature of being under the sea from that scene.
Yeah, actually, the scene where Brown takes that flower and hands it to Miss Price, and she goes to sniff it, and the little seahorse comes out. That reminds me a lot of the scene where Sebastian and all the other sea creatures serenade Ariel with Under the Sea.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. I can totally see that. So we're talking about music. Let's talk about the Sherman Brothers score, because this is one of my pet peeves with Disney, is that this soundtrack has not been like fully restored and re-released on CD or even on digital download or anything.
Yeah.
Like a few years ago, we had a big Mary Poppins CD set that's just fabulous, that has every bit of music from score to soundtrack to everything. That they released for that film's anniversary, but for this, they've never released the full soundtrack so that you could own it after the original release. And I don't understand it, because every other Sherman Brothers song is available, right? I mean, the Winnie the Pooh soundtrack's not been released, The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, but you can get all those songs, in various and sundry locations.
Yep.
But this is a Sherman Brothers Disney movie that you can't get the soundtrack to.
Very true.
Yes. Right, and I'm not even sure you can get all the songs other than stuff that people have recorded off the DVD and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the only song that I know of that is available, that was available commercially, is Age of Not Believing, and it was on that classic Disney set that was probably about 15, 20 years ago that came out on CD. Mm-hmm. But everything else, I mean, Portobello Road, Beautiful Briny Sea, the With a Flair song we talked about, you know, none of that stuff is available. And it's odd because, I mean, I'm going to say something blasphemous, but, you know, hey, whatever. These songs are every bit as good as the Mary Poppins songs. The difference is it's not Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke singing them.
Right.
I agree. I mean, but it's Angela Lansbury half the David Tomlinson. I mean, and you're right. They are very much equivalent to mm-hmm. them in terms of ability to sing, I think. Though I will put Julie Andrews on top of all four, but, you know.
There are very different ways to their singing style as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it's more of a case of Dick Van Dyke and Julie Andrews are bigger stars than David Tomlinson and Angela Lansbury.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they're most people are going to know who those two people are. Not a lot of people outside of the Disney community are going to know who David Tomlinson is. And most people are going to think of Angela Lansbury from Murder, She Wrote.
That's,
I mean, I'm just being honest. I mean, the woman's immensely talented. I'm just,
right.
you know, people
right.
don't give her the credit that she deserves for other things that she's done. So here's a question. So what was everyone's favorite song from the movie? What about you, Brie?
You guys go first. I'm passing.
Oh, oh. She's passing the buck. Todd, what would you say?
I know. I'm pretty sure I know what yours is.
Okay. I want to hear this now.
I'm pretty sure you like the Beautiful Briny Sea.
Portobello Road is
really?
My favorite, actually. Yes.
Okay.
I have been known to, when we're going to the mall, to sing Portobello Road and adapt the lyrics as needed.
Yeah, it's weird. Well, I'm trying to more think of it from which one sticks in my head the most, but I guess that's not necessarily my favorite one. So. I do like Portobello Road because it's very, very interesting because because, you know, Tomlinson, he's basically singing it himself. And those songs always entertain me. Like, even in when we watch Mary Poppins, same thing. When he sings songs by himself, they're just very entertaining. I also, strangely, I like Eglantine because it's like the most amazing use of a name in a song. Just like, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, totally. No, I love that song, too. Yeah.
And it sticks in my head, too, for some strange... That's the one that I think... That's like the It's a Small World of this movie, I think, is Eglantine. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that it just, you know, it gets stuck in your head and you're trying to think of what else you actually like, and I can't get it out of my head.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, my favorites are definitely... I have a hard time between Portobello Road and Beautiful Briny Sea as well, but like I said, I'm also got Eglantine in there. I don't dislike any of them, right? Just some of them are very short and terse, and I'm not sure if that's because of the lost footage. Like, if you look at, like, The Age of Not Believing.
Yeah.
Right? It seems like it's missing something. Because it kind of starts, and it kind of goes, and then it ends, but it's very quick.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I could see that.
Okay, and I don't know if there was supposed to be more to it or not. I have no interest in the old Home Guard song.
Yeah.
I could take it or leave it, to be honest. Nobody's Problems. I didn't like it because she just... It just didn't... I understood the moment, but I didn't like the song for the moment in the movie.
Yeah.
Right?
I think I chose my favorite.
Okay. What, did you listen to them all?
No, I had to look over the list again to remember
okay.
all the names, so I got this right. Substitutionary Locomotion.
Oh, so you like? Yeah. Now, what do you like about that?
I love the tune of it. I don't know. It's just it's a fun song. It's just fun and playful. I don't know. I like
okay.
it.
Okay, I can buy that.
That's my lame answer for the night.
No, that's a great song.
It's a great. But that goes to what Ryan was saying, is they're all great songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the difference in this, and I think the difference in this versus like a Mary Poppins is the songs in this were not, unless, I think they were crafted the same way that the Mary Poppins songs were, as in that they were given the book and they crafted the songs. But the songs in this are subservient to the story in a way that the songs in Mary Poppins were not. If that makes sense. Like, the songs here are much more along the lines of like a musical that you would see on the stage, in that they serve to forward the story along for the most part.
Well, Ryan, you know, they're actually more similar than you may think.
Really?
Yes, indeed. The song, The Beautiful Briny Sea, basically, was originally created for Mary Poppins.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because they were originally going to have the extended version of the Jolly Holiday sequence.
Yes.
Right, and it was supposed to be one of the scenes in that.
Okay.
So, and then they just saved it and they used it later in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, like they did. There were other songs that carried over to Winnie the Pooh and stuff like that also. So, you know, from Mary Poppins. So, you know,
yeah,
it
yeah.
got all of. There's also a moment, if you listen very carefully, in the scene where she gets her broomstick. Oh, yep. Well, her first broomstick.
Yeah.
If you listen to the undertones, you can actually hear the tune of A Spoonful of Sugar. If you listen to the music.
Oh. Okay. I'm going to have to listen to that again. Now, we've covered our favorite songs. Now let's cover our favorite lines in the entire film. If I may go first.
Absolutely.
I know I'm jumping here, but when she performs that almost the last spell and all the clothes in her house come to life and everything is happening, I absolutely adore when she says to Emilius Brown, "That is my nightgown. I am not responsible for its behavior."
Yes.
That is my favorite line in the entire film. I almost fell off my bed laughing. I know I'm not doing the line justice, but the way she brings it out, like, it's such good comedic timing there. I love it.
I like when Charlie, who's at that point, the age of non-believing, right? He's questioning everything at this point.
Right.
He asks, "Is the bed safe?" Right? And she goes, to him, "I don't know, Charles. There's a great many things about magic I don't know. We'll just have to find out."
Yeah.
Yes, and she's so calm about it. That's one of the things. That's what I was going to say. Is like, I don't know if I have like a favorite line, but what I love is the, I guess I could just call it the Britishness of the characters, and the way that they're so calm about everything, even though, you know, they could, you know, explode in this magical hyperspace or, you know, all these different things. And David Tomlinson, this is my favorite role of his in all the different Disney films he was in. So, you know, he was a bad guy in The Love Bug. He was a bad guy in Mary Poppins for the most part until he changes. But in this, I love that he's kind of the charming rogue or raconteur, you know? And
right.
I love his dialogue throughout the entire thing, where he's always twisting words to make it to his advantage and things like that. He does such a great job in this movie.
Yeah. If I may, also, I just want to mention two more quotes, which I absolutely adore. I think the captain toward the beginning, when that old man in front of the house has the gun, he's pointing the gun at him, and the captain goes, "I'm not to be menaced by that grotesque object." The way he comes out with that is just genius. And also Miss Price, when the kids first arrive at her house, and they ask her what the cat's name is. And she goes, "I don't believe in calling cats ridiculous names. I call him Cosmic Creepers, because that's the name he came with." As if that name is not ridiculous.
I had that written down also.
Yes.
I also like that there's a quick drop earlier than that in the movie that the cat literally did come to her. It was mailed to her by Professor Brown when he was Professor Brown from London. It was her package prior to the broomstick was Cosmic Creepers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's subtle, but it's in there right at the beginning.
Okay, I'm going to date myself here, but you know what this really reminded – the anime part really reminded me of is if you remember Laugh Olympics with Hanna-Barbera.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
All-Star Laugh Olympics, yes, indeed.
Yes, All-Star Laugh Olympics.
But that goes back to what I was saying because the Lenny Weintraub guy, right, he did half the voices in All-Star Laugh Olympics, right?
There you go.
But the animation, though, was right on it, too.
It really is. I also like that, again, because he's playing both the bird guy who introduces them to the king, and he's playing the king. He's, like, yelling at himself and stuff like that, and It's very entertaining. And he says his majesty is in a frightful rage. You know, again, going back to the pompous Britishness, is of all the animals, the bird is the pompous British character.
No, but it's a very good point that Cheryl brings up about the animation, because Ward Kimball was one of the people who pushed Disney away from the literal, you know, figure drawings that they did, like in Snow White and some of the other films, and towards a more representational style and a looser line and those sorts of things in his art. So he won an Academy Award for Toot Whistle Plunk and Boom, which is a short he did that is very much like the style of the stuff you guys are talking about with Laugh Olympics and things like that. And he was the one who was really influential in pushing Disney away from that, you know, direct translation of the human figure kind of animation into some more things that are more stylistic and things like that. So, this is a definite version of him doing that.
Yeah.
Very cool. I also like from the animated from Naboo Boo, I like the no peopling allowed sign.
Yes. No peopling allowed. So we talked about a few things in the movie, but one of the things I wanted to talk about is the movie was not a big success, right? It was a budget of around $20 million. It didn't even make its money back in its initial release or through the re-release, which is just strange to me. I don't understand that, just seeing the quality of the film itself. I guess, why do you guys think that Mary Poppins was such a huge hit and this was so not, and continues to be not, you know, not re-released? People haven't found the film, you know what I mean? Like, they haven't found it on DVD. It's not made a ton of money on DVD. It's one of those things that continues to sort of languish in obscurity.
Well, it's certainly there's a time difference, right? I mean, the beginning of the 60s was much different than the beginning of the 70s in terms of the types of movies people liked. I mean, that's when the movie industry really transited into being more daring.
That's true.
Okay, yeah. And this was really, this at the time in the 70s, this movie was really a throwback to the older styling, but that's where Disney was at the time, so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the time, Disney was just doing things in this period of time, this is after Walt's death, they were doing things that they thought would be Walt-esque.
Yeah, movies like The Apple Dumpling Gang, which is, you know, or, you know, Pete's Dragon is also from the 70s, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So not that these are bad movies. These are movies that I love. Okay. But at the same time, the movies that Disney was putting out at this time period, okay, were not the movies of the common culture at the time.
Yeah, right. That makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Yeah. I'll give you credit for that.
Definitely a league of its own.
Yeah, so it seems like it would make much more sense to somebody watching now and would be more interesting. So it's just weird. I don't know why people haven't found it in retrospect, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's as good as Mary Poppins.
Right.
Because it's not.
No.
But it's pretty darn close.
It is close. By the way, since we have reviewed Mary Poppins, I believe I gave it a 4. I have changed my vote to a 5. I just want to make that known. I also want to give props to Sam Jaffe, who played the Bookman. I love seeing him. I adored him in Gunga Din. That is one of my favorite films. I believe it's from 1939. Another TCM classic that I watch constantly.
Ooh, I have a piece of trivia about him. He was the only non-European actor to be in this movie.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That's great.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. So remember earlier we were talking that Dame Julie Andrews there, she turned down the role and then wanted it back, but Angela Lansbury had already had it at that point?
Yes.
The other person who was – David Tomlinson was not supposed to be playing Emilius Brown either. They originally wanted Ron Moody, who played Fagin in Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But
yeah, that's right.
But he couldn't. He wanted the role, but he couldn't do it due to a scheduling conflict.
So, wow! Everything happens for a reason.
Everything happens for a reason.
I'm very happy that Tomlinson is in the movie.
Me too.
I wanted to say that like I said earlier, Bedknobs and Broomsticks won the award for best visual effects. Okay, I just wanted to give credit where credit is due. Is that even though it's lit. Only three of the special effects artists are listed on the award. That's Alan Maley, Eustace Linsett, and Danny Lee. There's actually a fourth person who's uncredited on the movie who did special effects on the movie, and his name is Hans Metz, and I just felt the need to mention that.
He should be mentioned.
He should be mentioned, because the Academy doesn't recognize him, so I kind of feel bad about that.
Oh, how dare he?
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. It's awful. It's
how do they?
Mean.
That's really awful.
Sorry.
By the way, did anyone see in the beginning how the village loosely resembles the one in the beginning of Beauty and the Beast when she comes out and sings Belle? I think like they got that idea in Beauty and the Beast from this film. Like the way the village is shaped, it just looks that like that to me. I don't know.
Since you mentioned the city, I actually have another little tidbit there. In the third Kingdom Hearts game, this is the Pepper and Jai is actually one of the places where you have to play. And you actually team up with Miss Price, and you actually have to help her cast the substitutionary locomotion spell to defeat the boss in the level.
That's awesome.
That is. Do they have that for the Wii? I need to invest.
I don't know. Wow. It's a little old at this point, but I just thought it would bear mentioning. I'm going over. I like that. Like you said, the Roddy McDowell thing is interesting. Was his character in? I don't, because again, I only saw what I have vague memories, and it's just always the same memories of him. So I don't think I ever saw the longer version with him. Was he supposed to be Emilius Brown's, enemy in the movie or something like that? Was that the intent, like the other suitor, basically?
Yeah, I mean, it was like a subplot, and it wasn't well developed, which I think is why it was dropped.
Okay.
And I think they. I would imagine, this is my guess, and this happens on every movie, is that there was a lot more shot with Roddy McDowell that didn't end up even in the 3-hour cut. Because okay. even what is in the movie isn't that fleshed out, right? And I would imagine he had a bigger role and they cut it down, and then they've cut it down. They cut it completely out for the theatrical version. They put it back in for this version. And I mean, he's there, but he doesn't really, he's not necessary to the movie, right? They could cut it out of this version even, and it would be fine.
Okay, cool. I had a wonky Sluicy thing.
Yeah, you did.
Oh yeah, I do.
Of course. Right,
so a lot of the time throughout the movie, they refer to the Germans as the Jerrys.
Yes.
Okay. This was the colloquialism at the time. It started during World War I, but it didn't really pick up until World War II, as it didn't become common use until World War II. So this is actually how they, because there's a lot of ethnic names that end up at for wartime. It's very common. For example, the British themselves are referred to as the Tommies, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have the Charlies were the Viet Cong. Right, because it was Victor Charlie was how they were referred to.
Right.
So they were the Charlies. Ivan for Russians, and on and on and on like that, right? So here's where the interesting fact comes in, is that there's a term that we use in modern society called jerry-rigging, okay? A lot of people think it's jury-rigging, but no, that's a whole different thing.
Indeed.
Okay.
Sorry.
But what it is it's actually playing off of this referencing Germans as Jerrys, okay? Because towards the end of World War II, when the Germans were having problems with their equipment and they couldn't maintain them properly because they were on the run, okay, they would basically piecemeal their equipment back together, especially like their tanks and stuff like that. So that was that term became jerry-rigging, which is why where we get that term from today.
Awesome.
Okay then.
I thought you'd like that.
I do like that.
And my one last favorite thing, because I always like to get some sci-fi or comic booky reference in, other than the Lenny Weintraub guy. The main spell, the substitutionary locomotion spell, okay, which we should all just say it because people will kill us if we don't say the words in the podcast, okay? So it's Triguna Macoides Tricorum Satis D, okay.
Wait, I thought it was Astriomenthozynthos.
No, I'm getting to that. Don't jump.
Don, it scares me how fast you said that.
Is that the Freshmaker? Is that what you were talking about?
No, okay. So, again, substitutionary locomotion is Triguna Macoides Tricorum Satis D. Okay?
Wow. Yeah.
I could do that fast. Yes, I can. Amen. All right.
I actually could, too. I just haven't said it yet.
Yeah, you were avoiding it, right? But here's the important thing, right? So, they're the spell is supposed to be written on the Star of Astaroth, right?
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Well, there's a comic book character named Raven. She's a member of the Teen Titans, right? And she references this all the time. It was built into the original character, and it carried forward into the recent animated series, where they actually ended up referencing a few other things, including World of Warcraft in her main spell. Okay, so her main spell in the recent cartoon series, which I'm mentioning only because I figure more people know it than the actual comic book character necessarily, is she would always say Astaroth Metrion Xynthos. Okay, so it's and that Astaroth is actually a reference to this movie and the Star of Astaroth.
Oh,
that's pretty cool.
Yep. That is cool.
And
people referencing bedknobs and broomsticks, I love it.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to know if they ever returned the star back to the lion.
They didn't. It disappeared.
It disappeared, yeah. They didn't have to.
So what happened to it?
It went back to him.
Okay.
She says in the movie, you can't bring
no,
items.
No, I knew that. But so did it go back to him, or did it get lost forever?
I think they showed it turn into pixie dust, right?
Yes.
So that's what I think happened. It turned into pixie dust. I'm going with the pixie dust thing.
Okay.
I love
you go
it.
With your pixie dust, sir.
That's there you right. Go. I likes me some pixie dust.
Of course you do. All right, so Bedknobs and Broomsticks. It is a movie that we watched, and we will now rate. So, Mr. Todd Perlmutter, what do you think of Bedknobs and Broomsticks?
Well, I'm trying to think against movies. So, I like I said, I really love this movie. I am compelled, I think, to give it a 4 because I find it that entertaining to me. I just love watching it. Like I said, I've watched it many, many times in my lifetime.
Including 5 in the past month.
Including 5 in the past month.
I see no issues with this.
No, so I'm going with a 4. Like I said, I agree with you, Ryan, not as good or great as Mary Poppins, which I did not give a 5 to, but I gave as close as I'll get to a 5 because I don't think I've ever seen a 5 as a movie. Just so everyone knows.
What?
Yeah, we... Yeah.
That's an argument for another show.
So, like I said, it's a movie I love. It's a movie I love to watch. And I actually like the lighthearted nature of it. So.
And I agree. Miss Brianna Alessio, your thoughts?
All right. Well, you have the fantastic Sherman Brothers composing the music. You can never go wrong with the Sherman Brothers. You can never go wrong with Angela Lansbury or David Tomlinson. And in all honesty, you cannot go wrong with this movie. I am going to give it a solid 4.
And I will agree with both of you. I agree. A rare consensus among the group.
Well, except for me. I'm the dissenter of the group.
So I will also give it a 4. Cheryl does not share our adoration, as she has told me before.
I do not. It's a 3 for me. I mean, it's not, you know, I agree. I can see why the it was not, you know, the best at the box office, and I wouldn't put it at the 4 or 5. I wouldn't put it at the lowest of the low either. As I've been reminded, there are other movies, especially by CM Punk lately, I've been reminded that there are worse Disney movies, including some of those with The Rock.
There you go.
Indeed.
All right, so that will do it for this week's episode. We hope you have enjoyed our look at Bedknobs and Broomsticks. If you haven't seen the movie, I highly recommend that you go out and find a copy and watch it. Even though Netflix has raised the price of DVDs by mail about like tenfold or something today.
If you have Disney Movie Rewards points, I think that it's available there. So
yes, it is, and yeah. I actually think you can rent it from Disney Movies Online for like $4.
For $3.
$3. There you go.
Make it happen, people.
That's
make it happen.
That's $1 an hour, people. $1 yes. an hour. You can't beat
make
that.
Make it happen. Nope.
All right, so go check it out. If you have not seen it, I highly recommend it. It's one of those that you, if you're a Disney fan and you enjoy Disney movies, you're gonna want to watch this one. All right, so that will do it for this week's episode. Until next week, you can keep in touch with us on a variety of various interwebs platforms. You can go to the website disneyfilmproject.com, where you can read the show notes for the show. You can leave a comment about it. You can listen to older shows. You can just generally tell us what's going on in your life. You can read blogs. You can do great stuff. You can go to our Facebook page at facebook.com, Disney Film Project, where you can leave us a comment on this show. You can talk to other people. You can interact there. That's great. You can send us a tweet. We are at Diz Film Project, D-I-S Film Project. That's us. So send us a tweet, and we'll respond to you with our appropriate snarkiness and fun. You can keep in touch with us individually. We're all over the place. I believe between the four of us, we control 7/10 of the internet. Mr. Todd Perlmutter programs the entire internet, in case you didn't know that. he is the
That's why it's so wonky.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
I answer only to Al Gore.
Yes, exactly. you can see Todd's work at the DisneyDrivenLife.com, where he is, as previously mentioned, the Chief Technical Officer. And you can read his many and wonderful blogs at the TouringPlans.com. You'll also find my blogs at both of those locations, as well as Disney Film Project. And you can keep up with Miss Bree at The Adventures of Bree at AdventuresofBree.blogspot.com. So,
I got one to add.
You have? Uh-oh.
Yes, we're now built.
Sorry,
we're
8 now, out of 10 sites yes. on the internet.
No, not me personally. We're now, our podcast is now available on Stitcher Radio.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Yep. Woo! So you can go to Stitcher.com and you can download a client for your phone, or you can look for it right there, and you just search for Disney Film Project Podcast, and we'll come right up.
Awesome.
Nice.
See, you can just find us everywhere, people. That's what try to make it easy on you. So,
lurking around the corners.
Yeah. Tell a friend, if you would. Tell a friend to listen to the show. Bring 10 people in and have them watch the show. Go leave us a review in iTunes. That helps people find the show. Anything you can do would be greatly appreciated.
Wait, I have one more.
We got more recommendations.
Do a movie night with your friends with one of these movies.
That's right. Because you know what? If you go to the site, you can see what movie we're going to do next. And so everybody get together and watch that movie, and then you can listen to the show the next week. Great. Fun. Exciting. Everyone wins that way.
Or do them back to back.
There you go. Like do a whole weekend out of it. That's you know right. what I'm saying? It could be great fun for you and for the kids. All right. So that will do it with our look at Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Until next week, goodbye, y'all.
Bye.
Toodles.